$1,000 a week, plus gas money, plus commissions. One of them, when hired, actually fell to his knees and wept, saying the job would keep him from becoming homeless. Rob treated them very casually, like a big brother, careful not to give orders in a way that would engender any resentment at all. The only point he was aggressive about was that their cars have up-to-date registrations and functional taillights, and that they obeyed all traffic laws. Otherwise, he cracked jokes and gave them small kickbacks and tried to maintain a smooth dynamic. While careful to keep a certain distance, he presented himself as a mentor figure. "If you handle yourself this way and don't cause problems, you'll be where I'm at soon enough." To the mules, where Rob was looked pretty good. None of them ever saw the basement on Smith Street or knew any of the specifics of the enterprise. Their business was conducted in parks, parking lots, side streets. For 3 weeks, the situation worked out well. They were moving the product at almost a pound per day, and money was coming in. Less than Rob had originally calculated because of the new overhead of roughly $8,000 a month, but that would ultimately be a small dent. The first profits went to Curtis, Tavris, Drew, and Flowey to pay down their original investments. The money Rob took in himself he spent on back mortgage payments for the Greenwood house and Jackie, to whom he hadn't been able to contribute much since last November. The house on Chapman Street needed some radiator repairs. Frances was in her worst condition yet, undergoing dialysis for kidney disease in addition to her emphysema. He began paying off the credit card debts that the family had taken on for those costs. He was once again able to be generous with his friends, helping with rent, car repairs, and marijuana. At their current rate, the stash would be cleared out by midsummer, just in time to prepare for the Johnson & Johnson application process. Before he could start thinking fully forward, however, Kamar had to be handled. Kamar was one of his mules. He was 19 years old, small in stature, but able to carry himself like a heavy, complete with a full beard. At first he'd been very quiet. He listened. He was on time. His car never broke down. He worked harder than the others and never tried to renegotiate his stipend. Rob liked him. He respected the kid's work ethic and follow-through. The latter quality in particular was rare. "That one's got a future," Rob told Flowey. "Hopefully not in the game, but somewhere." Maybe Rob liked him a little too much. Maybe he grew lax during their exchanges. Maybe he allowed Kamar to feel like an associate rather than an underling. Their physical meetings happened one-on-one in the dark, so nobody knew. They only knew that by late April, Kamar had become a problem. Bits of gossip began filtering back from some of the buyers with whom Kamar had been dealing. "Watch out for that one. He's talking shit." Apparently, during drug deals, he'd been making comments about Rob, saying that he was smug, he was a cheat, he didn't know what he was doing. He was also talking about the Yale marker. The natural capacity for Rob's pedigree to draw resentment was at work once again. Overall, these rumors were harmless and had no effect on the business. As in any industry, low-rung workers undermined their bosses all the time. Words were currency, as they always had been, and it was important, career-wise, to present yourself as bigger than you were. The worry was that words would morph into something more serious. Rob's biggest concern was that Kamar would start talking to more people than simply the buyers. That the information would spread wide that he was running his own operation while still working for Amin, and that the operation was far-reaching. The possibility of this coming to pass was remote. Rob had made sure that none of his employees had any history with Amin, the local Bloods, or anyone else capable of intruding. But regardless, Rob had enough on his mind already. The severance occurred on the sidewalk outside Smith Street. Because Rob was hungover and didn't feel like driving to a more discreet location, he let Kamar pull up right outside the basement door. Curtis was inside playing video games when he heard the shouting. Kamar's voice was high-pitched, and though Curtis had met him only once and not directly, unmistakable. Rob's remained, as ever, low and controlled. The exchange was laced with profanities from Kamar, met with weary platitudes from Rob. Curtis's only real thought was that Rob should have done this somewhere else because he didn't want the neighbors to complain. After a short time, the car rumbled off and Rob came back inside. He laughed uneasily and said, "Damn, the young'uns be uppity these days." Curtis laughed and kept playing his game as Rob passed the TV room and returned to the basement. The talk started almost immediately and intensified fast. People around the neighborhood were worried because Rob's name was coming up in a bad way. In the kitchen of Smith Street, his cell phone would ring constantly, and he would take the calls into the backyard and speak in halting, unheard phrases. "You need to tell me something?" Flowey asked during the first week of May. He was concerned by how reclusive Rob had become, all but cutting Flowey out of the business transactions. In drug dealing, as at St. Benedict's, disengagement was always the first sign of trouble within. "No," Rob said, "nothing's going on." "Seriously, what is it?" Flowey had been in partnerships where the pulling away of another typically meant that he himself was getting screwed somehow. He didn't have to worry about this with Rob. He only had to worry about Rob, and the degree to which, unasked, he'd taken the entire enterprise on his shoulders. "The boy's asleep upstairs," Rob said, referring to Christopher on the second floor. "We'll talk later." There wasn't any time to talk later, because Rob wasn't around the house much anymore. Usually, neither Flowey nor the others knew where he was. They figured maybe Hitaway's or Lisa Wingo's, and sometimes they were right. Lana, his Croatian girlfriend, visited that week, and Rob slept with her a couple of times on Hitaway's couch. They made enough noise during their coupling to wake Hitaway and Marina's infant son, and Rob was told that he couldn't stay there anymore. Rob had no plans to, anyway. For the first 2 weeks of May, he slept in his car in random parking spaces around East Orange, so that violence, were it to trail him, would not do so in the homes of anyone he loved. How dark and still and quiet those nights must have been, reclined in the passenger seat with a blanket covering his chest. How he must have thought of the various places he'd slept during his 30 years, the hundreds of different beds, Chapman Street, Smith Street, Landman Wright Hall and Pearson College, the apartment with the French doors overlooking Ipanema, Ohio and Florida, and Japan and South Korea and Costa Rica and Amsterdam, Hitaway's and Lisa Wingo's and Ina's and Renee's and the Raymond brothers, various airplanes flying 7 miles above the world's oceans. How he must have questioned the decision points that had led to him sleeping here, now, in his chilly car, alone in the streets to which he'd always been drawn. He wore a Kevlar vest on these nights, and during certain segments of the day. He also owned a handgun now, which he kept close. Though there are no accounts of Rob ever following through on his plan to sell weapons on the black market, a plan that, like so many others he had, seems to have fallen by the wayside. He did purchase one. Amin, the dealer for whom Rob still worked, hadn't in fact learned about his massive dealings, but members of the Double-Eye Set Bloods had. Apparently, Kamar had deduced that what he'd been involved in and fired from had involved more than just a few ziplocks of weed, and he'd decided to raise his station by getting in good with the most powerful entity in East Orange. The Yaley was working in secret, Kamar said, and in a big way, in their territory. This was a lie. The essential aspect of Rob's initial instructions to Kamar and the other mules had hinged on the layout of territory in East Orange and the specific blocks they were to venture nowhere near. But fact-checking wasn't a major tenet of gang behavior. Immediate action was. Rob suspended his dealings for the time being. He spent his time trying to figure out how to plug the freely flowing stream of information. He needed to talk to someone associated with the Double-Eye Sets and do so quietly, safely. He was good at talking. Given the right chance with the right person, he was certain he could explain honestly his intentions and his dealings while outing Kamar as an unreliable source with a petty vendetta. He had two concerns. The first was that he didn't want to get Kamar hurt. The second was that, were he to stage his outreach under the wrong circumstances, there wouldn't be time to talk. He finally told his friends what had happened, and his admission, while standing in direct contrast to all his initial promises, was received calmly without anger. The guys had not helped him as much as they'd promised, but they wanted nothing more than to fix the situation. "We should get rid of the stuff," Drew said. "For real, we're paid out, no harm done." "No," Rob replied, "I just need a minute to get on top of this." "Come on," Curtis said, "it's not worth it." Rob looked at Tavris, their real estate vision with its many charts and graphs passing through the eye contact. "Give me 3 days," Rob said. Nearly a plea. "No one's going to do anything in 3 days. Certainly not that little punk-ass Kamar. I can get it right by then." They'd entered into this dialogue, hoping to be reassured by Rob's demeanor, if not his words. But Rob looked cold, antsy, the opposite of peaceful. In the New York Star-Ledger, a few days later, a front-page article referenced the previous March 2010, which had been New York's first murder-free calendar month in over 40 years. The first quarter of 2011 had shown a 71% uptick in violent crime compared to the same period of last year. "You work until you're 65 and your benefits go up almost 20%, Rob told his mother. Jackie was 63 and dreaming of retirement. She knew that one of her son's most enduring motivations had always been to allow her to retire early, much earlier than 63. She didn't hold it against him that he was now convincing her, with numeric logic, to hold out until 65. According to the tables he'd found, if she retired now, she'd receive $964 per month in Social Security payments as opposed to $1,201 per month if she worked for two more years. They were sitting across from one another in the parlor. The curtains hung down over the window right behind Rob's head, the same curtains she used to chastise him for poking his face through while waiting for his father to arrive. Jackie took them down twice a year for cleaning. The street was semi-visible through the lace. Spring was beginning to manifest in earnest. New weeds in the vacant lot across the street had almost reached the height of the fence. Clusters of children passed by in their navy uniforms, walking home from school, looking forward to the summer. Jackie nodded her head and said, "Yeah, yeah, I know you're right." She hadn't really been serious about retiring this year, but had nurtured the idea as a pleasant fantasy. She'd been working at the nursing home for 15 years. The recession had hit the company hard, and she'd taken a pay cut, but she was still making over $30,000 a year supervising the kitchen, and her pension and benefits would remain intact. The $237 extra per month would make a difference in the long run. Her son made sense with numbers he always had, and now he was 30 years old, taking her through the tiers of retirement benefits. She wished that these calculations hadn't always been so challenging, not in terms of the math, but its implications. She knew that he wished the same thing, but she didn't fix any anger, as her son did, to that wish. She'd entertained many such wishes during the course of her life and had long since accepted the reality that very few of them would come true. She'd wished that Skeet had been innocent. She'd wished for jackpots with each crank of an Atlantic City slot machine. She'd wished that her boss would slip and fall and hit his head hard enough that he would suddenly become kind. She'd wished that her mother would be able to pass on without further suffering. She'd wished that her son would be able to make his way in the world easily, successfully, and happily. When she'd been 30, she hadn't yet given birth to him. In retrospect, her life hadn't even begun because Rob would ultimately become her life. He was still more or less a child. He had time, but she couldn't explain this brand of time to him. She wasn't good with words that way. By the middle of May, any danger Rob felt himself to be in seemed, at least to his friends, to have subsided. He spent one night at Tamba's house, a DJ friend of his who lived around the corner from Smith Street, playing spades until 4 in the morning. He told Floyd that he'd talked to someone, a blood, and it was all on the up and up again. Kamar hadn't been seen or heard from in over a week. Bitch left town, no doubt, now that I outed his lion ass. He filled the void left by Kamar himself, spending most nights driving around, selling dimes, music blaring, and the window down as his car worked the freeways and bridges and tunnels surrounding New York City. He texted with Lisa Wingo incessantly. Lisa, you don't visit a sister? Peace, gotta lay low. Lisa, what you been doing? Peace, ripping and running. Lisa, be careful. Peace, always. Peace, oh, and I started watching Glee yesterday. Peace. Don't tell anyone. Lisa, smiley face. Lisa, and you love it. Peace, more than I thought possible. Peace, shh. Lisa, see? Told you. Peace, just watch the episode where they did CeeLo's song Forget You. Lisa, ha 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 ha. Peace, I know, this is our little secret though, right? Lisa, who the hell am I gonna tell? Peace, just making sure. Lisa, I'm a blast you on Facebook. Lisa, just like a man. You like Glee, but don't want to admit it. Punk. Peace, you so mean. He wore the Kevlar vest whenever he was in the car, night and day, but he kept the gun buried in the spare tire compartment of the trunk or else in a ground floor closet at Smith Street. An afterthought or maybe a reminder, but nothing more. I just can't believe I know someone with a gun in his car, Raquel told him. He had stopped by to give her weed so she could make brownies, which he called dem shits. Who the fuck does that? He shook his head and smiled. It'll be done with soon enough. He gave her a hug and told her to give one to Felix for him when the boy woke the next morning. Then he left. From the window, she watched his shadow cross 119th Street and get in his car and head west toward First Avenue. She imagined him driving over the gorgeously lit George Washington Bridge, alone, with that sober expression on his face that being stoned could no longer mask. On Thursday, May 12th, he took Lisa Wingo and her daughter to Red Lobster for dinner. She gave him a hard time for ordering a pineapple cocktail complete with an umbrella skewering a stack of fruit slices. She argued over the check, but ultimately let him pay. His happiness was always the most genuine when he was taking care of her in some mannish way such as this, paying a bill, lifting a heavy box, bringing food to the apartment. They joked sometimes about an alternate world in which they were husband and wife. "You're too pretty for me," he said. "My little Oompa Loompa." After dinner, she asked him where he was going. "Get some ass."
"Who with?"
"Brooklyn."
"Well, have fun.
If she's already asleep when I get there, I'll kill her. I ain't paying no $12 tolls just to go to bed." Renee was asleep, but he woke her, and they made love, and afterward he talked once again, in that deep refrain about providing for her someday. She let him talk. His voice was a pleasing sound by which to drift off to sleep, a white noise. That weekend, the Burger Boys had a cookout in the backyard on Smith Street. Friends came in and out down the side alley between houses. In fold-out chairs along the fence, men and women passed a joint back and forth. Music played, old-school songs like Rough Riders' Anthem by DMX and Put It On Me by Ja Rule. Lisa came, her mousy voice rising high above the men's low tones. Flowey held court, his long arms waving loops above his tall, narrow frame as he talked. Curtis showed off the watermelon vines he'd planted in his garden this year, the tiny buds that in a few months would be monstrous and succulent. Christopher scurried around in waist height until his bedtime, at which point Tavris and Darlene both took him upstairs to read books. Rob was in a quiet mood. He worked the grill for hours, slow roasting his Brazilian pork with a spatula in one hand and a drink in the other. His face lit brightly whenever the rendered fat caused a flare-up out of the charcoal bed. His eyes were angled down into the flames as he carefully scooted the meat toward the edges of the grill. A friend from Mount Carmel Elementary, Demian, taught karate classes at a local dojo, and Rob had been training with him recently. Intense, battering workouts that taught him a specific set of combat moves that leveraged an opponent's power against him. Rob asked Demian how he could live on the minuscule salary he made there.
"I don't know," Demian shrugged. "I can pay rent, eat. That's good enough with how much I love what I do."
The night felt happy and old, a return to form no different from the hundreds that had occurred over the years since high school, but also a foreshadowing of times to come. Tavris returned to the yard from Christopher's room upstairs. He was drunk and talking loudly about the latest long-term idea he and Rob had conceived. They wanted to establish a kind of training college in which students would come straight out of high school and learn practical skills like how to interview and dress and work for a corporation. The curriculum would be tiered over 3 years. The first year would be purely classroom lessons taught by local business owners. The second year would involve an intensive internship in one's chosen field. The third year would segue into an actual job, with a certain percentage of salary set aside to pay for the full tuition on the back end. Tavris spoke in big terms about how necessary such an institution would be in this neighborhood, how meaningless the traditional secondary education ultimately was to people like him, loading up on debt in order to study liberal arts with no practical value.
"You talk too much," Rob called from the grill.
"This isn't even an idea yet. This is like the far future, like decades away, and who knows what the educational system's going to look like then. Chill."
On Monday, May 16th, Rob showed up at Sherman Feerick's house in Bloomfield. Sherman was a former classmate from Yale, a staple at the Weed Shack. They'd remained good friends over the years, though Sherman did not overlap much with Rob's other friends. He had a 7-year-old daughter and was active in Newark's business sector as a consultant. He was constantly talking on one of his 3 cell phones, filling the atmosphere around him with business speak that Rob didn't understand.
He had worked off and on as a liaison between the mayor's office and the gang entities of the North Ward, though a murder on the street outside his office in Valesburg, in the middle of the day when he'd brought his daughter to work, had caused him to rethink his capacity to bring any form of progress to these neighborhoods. He was thinking about moving to Orange County in California to give his little girl a healthier life. In the meantime, his latest venture was a summer camp for at-risk children. For all Sherman's goings-on, his home was small and barely furnished. Rob sat at the kitchen table, uncharacteristically quiet as he stared down at the nicked wooden surface. He didn't take off his leather jacket. "I need some work," he said. "Okay," Sherman replied. He was confused. Rob had never asked him for anything in over a decade of knowing each other. "I was thinking I could be like a counselor at your camp or whatever."
"You'd be great at that," Sherman said.
"So, you got any openings?"
Sherman shook his head.
He didn't have the money to pay any actual wages. "Our fundraiser is in June. I'm putting it together right now. After that, yeah, I'll probably be able to make a spot for you if you can hold out till then."
Rob breathed out and nodded. Sherman felt for him, knowing how hard it had been to come here and ask for a job, wishing he had a job to give. He was also flummoxed by the defeated, desperate expression on his friend's face. Too much time had passed, too many opportunities had come and gone, for Rob Peace to still not have his life figured out. Sherman experienced something close to pity as his old friend left. If Rob had come even a few months earlier, Sherman probably could have figured something out for him. He had the contacts to do so. They were close enough that Rob shouldn't have needed to wait until the last possible moment to ask. He had never understood why Rob had found so much shame in asking. 2 days later, on Wednesday, Rob woke up late after a long night working in the basement. He picked up Christopher from school and brought him back to Smith Street, where he hung out with the boy for 2 hours in the backyard. When Darlene came home, Rob took a Tupperware container with the leftover pork to Chapman Street. Jackie was working, so he left it in the refrigerator with a note that read, "Ma, bon appétit, love, Sean." That evening, he texted some friends and watched TV with Curtis. The two men sprawled on the sofa like college kids in her dorm room. Tavis was upstairs with his family. Rob was in an upbeat mood, as if beginning to see through to the other side of this task he'd undertaken. After a time, they moved to the kitchen to cook dinner. Curtis washed sweet peppers from his garden in the sink. Before he finished the stir-fry he was preparing, Rob stood up, arched his back severely with his hands locked behind him, and let all those bones pop.
"Hang out and eat," Curtis said. "Then go to bed. You haven't slept in like a week."
"I'll hang out later. Got to do some work downstairs first."
"Come on, just take a break."
"Just want all this done," Rob mumbled, leaving the kitchen through the rear door, turning left down the stairs. Then they heard the car pull up in the driveway. Chapter 16. From his angle in the kitchen, Curtis couldn't see what happened in the rear stairwell. He heard Rob open the back door on the landing half a level below the kitchen and above the laundry room to see who had pulled up. Rob muttered, "Ah, shit," and began to close the door, then froze with the door half open. It must have been too late. In the days following, when Curtis gave his account to the police, he would guess that at this point, not 3 seconds after his final exchange with Rob about eating and sleeping, someone outside already had a gun trained on his best friend. The door swung open, and Rob was saying, "Chill, chill, chill," as the footsteps of at least two, possibly three, men seemed to back or prod him down the stairs toward the basement. Curtis didn't try to get a clear look into the stairwell because he was running toward the front of the house, his diaphragm pressing up against his lungs such that breathing became difficult. Already he heard yelling in the basement, though he could not make out the words. The men who had invaded his home wanted something, and Curtis did not need to be thinking coherently, which he was not, to discern what that was, because they had pushed Rob immediately downstairs without even checking the rest of the house. They must have known where Rob did his work, which meant they had talked to someone with knowledge of both the money and the drugs. Curtis reached the front door, his plan at this point simply to start yelling outside as loud as he could, draw some bodies out of the neighboring houses and onto the street. During any time of year, during any time of day or night, a street was always safer when people were on it.
If neighbors congregated outside wondering what the hell was going on, these men would hear that, and they would leave the way they'd come in. If Curtis was lucky, he wouldn't even have to call the police. Curtis was not lucky. Before he opened the front door, he saw a man, or possibly a teenager, standing watch directly outside, wearing a hoodie and leaning against the wall at the bottom of the front steps so that he could cover the stoop, the sidewalk, and the front basement door simultaneously. His hand was buried elusively in his pocket. His face was hidden. The basement had been largely cleared since that initial procurement of their stash. The marijuana was hidden in a trunk wedged back on one of the metal storage shelves. The hydroponic planters had been dismantled as Rob had dried enough plant matter to see him through the remaining poundage of sour diesel. Money was down there, maybe a few $1,000s. The men had been inside the house for maybe 20 seconds at this point, and they were still yelling. The kind of yelling that indicated something important was at stake. Yelling that negated the value of human life. Curtis couldn't pick out Rob's voice, which was alarming because Rob's voice was so distinctive, and it was unlike him to not be taking control of the situation, calming people down as he'd done with Booby a few years ago on the sidewalk where the watchman now stood. Talking was Rob's talent. Curtis moved backward away from the front door and its guard toward a storage closet in the hallway. As he did so, his mind cycled through the possible circumstances in play downstairs. They could have been some of Rob's buyers, desperate enough to risk ripping them off. They could have been involved with a threatened local dealer here to make a statement. They could have been Amin's people responding to rumors. They could have had something to do with Kamar and his recent associations with the Double Eye Set Bloods. They could have been anyone, really, any of the dozens of people, both local and farther flung, with whom Rob worked now or had in the past, people who Rob had confidently assured the Burger Boys they would never know anything about. Curtis thought, here, now, of how vastly compartmentalized his best friend's life was, how even with all the hundreds and hundreds of nights he'd spent in this house, he'd spent just as many nights out there in places unknown. For the most part, until recently, Rob's shadiness and mysteriousness regarding his conduct outside the realm of 34 Smith Street had been a source of amusement. He was always acting as if he were living a hustler's life, when most likely he'd been home on Chapman Street watching sitcoms with Francis and Jackie, or at some woman's house helping her kids study math, or getting laid in Brooklyn. All of his cumulative dour expressions and weighty sighs and murmured phone calls taken in the other room had always struck them to some extent as being staged by a guy who, hard as he presented himself to be, was just a mama's boy Yaley at heart. They'd always let him play the role, as most people in his life had, believing it to be, for the most part, simply that, a role. It wasn't real. It wasn't dangerous. It wasn't uncontrollable. It was just marijuana. It was just Rob Peace. Maybe 30 seconds had passed since the break-in. Curtis was pulling the gun from the closet, the gun Rob had been carrying around town lately. Except for visits to the firing range with Rob and a few other friends, he had no experience with guns. He checked the chamber, which was loaded, and he moved back toward the rear stairway. He cocked the gun, unaware that this motion was unnecessary when a round was already chambered. He heard Rob's voice now, his tone defensive and deflecting and scared, and then Rob stopped speaking abruptly, too abruptly. Curtis descended the stairs slowly, first to the landing by the back door, then down the last flight into the laundry room. He squatted between the wooden railing for cover. On the far side of this area, about 8 feet away, a very tall, robust black man filled the entire doorway of the basement, facing away from Curtis and into the room. He was wearing a ski mask and holding a gun at his side. The majority of men figure that when put in a situation where life hangs in the balance, both your own and that of those you care about, some dormant primal instinct will activate, and you will be strong and decisive and precise and intelligent with every movement. In this moment, Curtis learned that such an instinct did not exist, or at least not in him. His weapon quavered, as did his voice, when he called out to Rob to ask if he was all right. The man in the doorway turned but didn't seem particularly startled. They exchanged charged words from either end of the laundry room. Curtis wouldn't remember exactly what had been said, only that he'd alternated a few times between ordering the intruders out of his house and pleading for Rob to say something, just one word, to let Curtis know he was okay. But behind the blocked door, Rob remained silent. which signaled that at least one more man was in the basement, most likely with a gun aimed at him. Then the large man opened fire toward the stairs where Curtis crouched, and Curtis pulled his own trigger, but the gun didn't fire. He'd jammed the chamber when he'd cocked it moments earlier. The large man was advancing now, gaining an angle over the railing, and Curtis bolted back upstairs, crouching low. The back door was closed and locked, so he pivoted 180 degrees on the landing and climbed back toward the kitchen. The large man's weapon was popping off behind him, sounding like the M-80s they'd set off in the yard as boys. On the stairway, one level above, Tavris was standing with a laundry basket. He'd been on his way down to do a load of Christopher's school clothes. Curtis screamed at him to get back upstairs before fleeing behind the refrigerator. He peered around the edge and saw the large man's arm curled around the stair railing on the landing, firing blindly, bullets strafing the side of the refrigerator, the stove, the walls. Then the firing stopped. Curtis was cornered. If he tried to run across the kitchen back toward the front of the house, the man would have a line of sight on him. If he stayed here with a gun that didn't work, he was most likely dead, too. He was breathing fast enough that he couldn't hear very well. He remained huddled against the refrigerator until he heard footsteps on the back stairs, more shouting voices, the back door opening and closing, the car peeling out of the driveway. Then silence. Curtis ran outside. They were already gone. Perhaps 2 minutes total had elapsed since they'd first entered, maybe less. What his first impulse had been to do, Curtis did now. He screamed to bring the neighbors out of their homes, to make the area safe with people the Burger Boys had known since high school. But people were already outside in response to the shots. An elderly woman next door, whose bedroom window was not more than 6 feet away from the back door of 34 Smith Street, had already called the police, who were on their way. Tavris was outside now, too. Christopher had woken up, but was groggy. Darlene was upstairs with him. They were safe. Curtis told Tavris to call people, as many as he could, just get people over here. And then, since the police were coming, he headed for the basement to see about getting the drugs out of his house. He figured that Rob was already doing the same thing. He figured that Rob, as ever, was one step ahead of everyone else. Downstairs, beyond the laundry room where Curtis had almost been killed, the tarp had fallen back over the basement door. Curtis lifted it, calling out to his friend. Rob is lying face down on the floor, his knees bent and tucked beneath his torso, his arms folded under his chest. He had crumpled forward off the sunken love seat on which he'd been sitting. He wasn't moving. Blood that had pooled underneath him, contained by the position of his limbs, was just beginning to trickle past his face toward the small water drain just off-center in the faux tile floor. Afterward, Curtis wouldn't remember any words he said or whether he had even been breathing. He just knew that his friend was not. He turned the body over. Rob was a dense man, maybe 175 pounds, but Curtis, still pulsing with adrenaline, didn't register the weight. Rob's shirt, soaked with blood, clung to his chest and stomach. His eyes were closed and his mouth parted as his head tipped back over Curtis's thigh. He must have been screaming for someone to get down there because that's what Tavris did, and he must have been rocking the body, cradling the head in his right elbow, weeping because that was how the East Orange police officers found him 20-odd minutes later, before ordering him to stand up and put his hands in the air. Jackie was awakened at 1:30 by someone knocking on the front door. The knocking was barely audible, which meant it was likely some vagrant testing to see if anyone was home. This had happened before, which was why she refused to sleep in this house without a man present. Carl was there tonight in Rob's old room. She waited to see if he would rise to take care of it, but he'd been drinking and never stirred. So she got up, put on a housecoat, and went halfway down the stairs, ready to hiss that whoever was out there was about to wake her sick mother, and in the meantime the phone was in her hand to call the police. But she recognized the tall, long, lanky silhouette outside the front door immediately. Flowey. She turned on the porch light and opened the door. "Ma," he said, "it's Sean. We gotta... He turned away from her, back toward the deserted street, eyes wet and swollen. Tavris had called Flowey an hour earlier, frantic but not making much sense, and he'd hung up quickly. Flowey had driven to Smith Street, but he hadn't been allowed past the yellow tape. Police cars were lined up at odd angles, flashing rhythmically. He'd seen the ambulance and connected its presence with the one decipherable word Tavris had said, Sean. From the porch where officers were talking to Curtis and Tavris, Tavris had managed to call out to him, "Go take care of Ma." Floey had driven to Chapman Street, and now all he could say was that they needed to get to Curtis's house. Jackie remained calm and composed. She imagined that Rob had been arrested for something she'd always convinced herself that he hadn't been involved with, and the days ahead of her would entail hours in precinct waiting rooms, the logistics of bail and lawyers, and the hard but doable task of aligning her vision of her son's life with what that life actually was. "Let me get dressed," she said. "I'll drive you." He was choking on his words, she assumed out of embarrassment or because he might be in trouble too. "I'll drive myself," she replied, and she turned back into her house, calling to Carl's unhearing ears that she was going out. Floey followed her east along Central Avenue, then right onto Telford, down into the dark, narrow gridwork of the neighborhood. Another ride on Tremont, then left on Smith, where the red and blue lights spun 200 yards down the block. Cars were backed up from the house, some belonging to friends who had heard something about the night's events, others just people trying to get through to South Orange Avenue. Jackie was already out of her car and hurrying down the sidewalk when Floey put his in idle. Walking to the house, he passed policemen asking neighbors if anyone had surveillance footage of the street, as if these people's homes were equipped with modern security systems. He caught up to Jackie. A young white policeman had met her at the Tate barricade. "You can't pass through this way, ma'am." "It's my son," she said. "My son is in that house. You can't pass through this way." Floey towered behind her, his confusion and sadness turning into anger. "It's the boy's mother. Let her through." The house was crowded with uniformed men clustered around the basement door and the stoop. Two more officers came down from the porch and approached. They consulted with one another and with their radios, then faced Jackie again. "You can't come through here, ma'am." Floey began, but Jackie laid her hand against his chest. Her face remained calm, so impossibly calm amid the lights and uniforms and spectators looking on with the sober, downcast expressions that Floey had seen surrounding crime scenes growing up on his block, that Jackie had seen on her block too. These expressions appeared only in reaction to violence, to pointlessness, to tragedy. "Where is he?" she asked. "Is he still inside there?" The officers consulted again, this time only with their eyes. They told her that a man had been taken to the hospital, but they refused to give a reason, name, or condition. Floey's big hands, so perfect for palming water polo balls, were on her shoulders. Quickly now, he was realizing what he'd known intuitively since he'd answered that call from Tavris. His friend was either dead or close to it. Police behaved differently when someone had died than when someone had been wounded. They behaved just as they were behaving now, repeating evasive scripted statements over and over. "You can't come through here, ma'am." Floey pulled gently on Jackie's shoulders, and she turned away from the house with him. They went back to the cars, and he followed her again, this time to East Orange Hospital, where she had once spent 12-hour days cooking meals. Floey took over the questioning while Jackie sat in the ER waiting room, hands folded in her lap, eyes pointed at the floor as her body rocked gently forward and backward. Anyone who looked vaguely associated with the hospital, he grabbed and asked where Sean Peace was. Then he realized that these people wouldn't know Rob's middle name, the name he went by in the hood, and started asking for Robert Peace instead, what Rob had called his nom professionnel. Regardless of the name, nobody could tell him anything. He kept being passed off by doctors and nurses and administrators, who seemed to put a special effort into looking harried and important, and being needed urgently somewhere else. "It's the man's mother here, and nobody's telling her anything. This is fucked up." Floey was not a violent man. His nickname had derived from growing up peacefully in one of the city's most unpeaceful neighborhoods. But he had anger in him that began to rise very fast up his spine. An administrator appeared and threatened to kick him out of the hospital if he couldn't be more patient and less profane. He sat beside Jackie. Finally, almost an hour later, a nurse said that a John Doe had been brought in from 34 Smith Street, nothing more. Another hour passed. Floey, fuming, noticed that Jackie was crying as quietly as it was possible for a human being to cry. "Let's go," he said. "You need to rest. Sean's okay. We'll find that out soon enough." He followed her home from the hospital and walked her to the front door. The phone had been ringing at the house, and Carl and Francis were awake.
It was 5 in the morning, the first faint glow radiating from the horizon to the east where the city was. Carl had spoken with Tavris by now. He knew that Rob was dead. On the front porch of 181 Chapman Street, while Flowey watched from the cracked stairwell by the sidewalk, Carl took Jackie into his arms and whispered into her ear. Frances was wailing faintly inside, her respiratory system not capable of volume. Jackie nodded silently as if she already knew, then moved slowly inside with him. "Ma," Flowey called, but no one heard him or else didn't respond. He didn't know what he'd meant to say, at any rate. He drove back to his apartment on Munn Avenue. His girlfriend Laquisha was out of town. His cell phone was ringing every few minutes. He didn't answer or call anyone back. He lay in his bed and stared at the ceiling. The room was dark and very quiet, aside from the neighborhood sounds that invariably rose to the 7th-floor window, cars passing by with the early-to-work shift, dogs barking in backyards, and the ever-present sirens. They'd confiscated everything, including the dismantled planters, and now the basement was a mess of overturned furniture, chalk and fingerprint dust, decades worth of the Gamble family's stored detritus. They'd searched the entire house for more drugs and money, so the upper floors were a disaster, too. Darlene had taken Christopher to her parents' house, and Curtis had been taken into custody by the police. Tavris found himself drawn to the basement. The blood remained pooled in and around the chalk outline of Rob's body, lying on his side as he had rolled off Curtis's lap when the police had arrived. The narrow profile drawing didn't look anything like Rob, or any person at all. The red trail that led to the drain had congealed. Tavris squatted at the trail's midpoint. They would be back before long, maybe even in minutes, and he'd been instructed not to enter the basement or touch anything. Two, there were murderers out there in the hood somewhere, probably laughing about having done this smart-ass Yaley but good. Tavris didn't care. His friend had been here in the house with Curtis, talking, laughing, being Rob. And then he was unconscious and bleeding out on the floor, and now he was gone. Rob Peace was gone. He would never come back the way he had from all those trips abroad, coasting through the front door to make himself a drink and catch up on what he'd missed. He was just gone, gone, gone. The holding cell where Curtis waited between questioning sessions was crowded with vagrants and dealers and Johns and drunks of Newark. Curtis had made his phone call to his mother. She would get him out of here soon. He sat on a bench in the corner, leaning far over so that his head was nearly resting on his knees. For the most part, the other criminals left him alone. Each man seemed lost in his own interior. In the basement of his house had been a dead body, dozens of pounds of marijuana, and thousands of dollars of illegally obtained cash. The questioning, both at the scene and here at the precinct, had been aggressive, beginning with the events directly surrounding the murder and segueing harshly into the circumstances of the basement lab and grow house. He forgot most of what he'd told them, except that he'd been honest about the home intrusion and his whereabouts during it, but he'd pleaded ignorance regarding the drugs as well as the gun that had jammed on him, which he'd left lying beside the refrigerator. He must have sounded like a fool, saying that he never went into the basement, that the basement was Rob's room, that Rob paid rent for it. No one else knew what was going on down there. Charges would be formally filed against him. No universe existed in which they wouldn't be. During the questioning, he'd gotten the impression that he might even be held accountable for the murder itself. These were the immediacies that his mind had no option but to confront, even as they paled in comparison to the life that had been taken tonight. He thought of all those parties in high school, all those cookouts in the backyard, all the nights out at the bars and clubs. He thought mostly of Rob cracking his joints, laughing, calling him a bitch for something he'd said or done. Rob's laugh had been oddly high-pitched compared to his baritone voice, as if his true spirit were released only in those moments, the stupid, humorous ones. Curtis cried, sniveling tears like those cast by a small child, and he feared that as a result these other imprisoned men would be drawn toward him, attuned to the naked weakness and looking to take some kind of advantage. But everyone remained still and quiet as night became morning. In the morning, Jackie received a call from the police, asking if she would be able to go to the city morgue and identify the body thought to belong to Robert Deshawn Peace.
she told Carl to stay with Francis, and she drove downtown nearly the same route she'd taken to St. Benedict's on the days she'd dropped Rob off. She parked and placed one foot in front of the other until she stood in the cold, metallic room that smelled of chemicals, and watched the coroner fold the white sheet down from her son's face. She nodded and said, "Yeah, that's Sean, that's my son." From there, she drove straight to work. Chapter 17. From Facebook to Jeff Hobbs. Subject: Victor Raymond sent you a message on Facebook. "Hey, Jeff, you might not remember me, but I was your roommate's Rob Peace's best friend. I came down to visit him at Yale a few times throughout the years. Well, I regret to inform you that he passed away. I'm trying to figure out a way to notify his Yale friends. The only one I knew to contact was you. Please let me know if you need further information. Sorry to inform you this way. Victor." This message brayed on my phone just before midnight on Thursday, May 19th, the day after Rob died. The words wiped away the drowsiness caused by two Seinfeld reruns. A few shocked back and forths confirmed what I instinctively knew already. My college roommate of 4 years had died violently. But they did not give much else, not even the minor consolation of knowing he'd made the ultimate transition without pain. The death of someone you know is so vastly different from reading of the same event happening to a stranger. You are familiar with their friend's face and voice, and so you are haunted during the overstimulated state of being wide awake at 4 in the morning by the very specific expressions and sounds he might have made as a bullet, perhaps more than one, passed into his body. The terrible resoluteness of this passage had likely happened not long after my wife and I, 3,000 miles away, had undergone our nightly square dance. One flosses while the other brushes, then switch, patting softly on the floorboards so as not to wake our little girl. A Yale graduate lost to the drug trade seemed so far-flung and bizarre that the task of relating this to our college community was barely short of incapacitating. But still, the tidy Facebook search, poke, send features provided the necessary distance for me to friend a few dozen people I was no longer, or in some cases, had never been, friends with in order to inform them that our mutual friend was gone. The responses I received all fell along the lines of, "Jeff, it is so great to hear from you, but what horrible news. How did this happen?" The bombardment of questions to which I had no answers only made me feel less fit for the task, particularly when I was corresponding with those who knew him far better than I, such as Raquel and Daniela. Some inquiries were as simple as the when, where of the funeral. I had conflicting times, addresses. While others asked, in the cosmo-religious sense, why. Being more or less a Christmas and Easter churchgoer, I had no clue. The answers I did manage to learn in the days preceding the burial remained broad and over-earnest and sometimes contradictory. He was dealing only to support his mother. All he wanted was to live in South America. He was broke. He was trying to go back to school. He was going to get out of it soon. He was trying to open up his own pharmacy. What had happened wasn't supposed to have happened, and yet they still rendered the predictable media spin of potential squandered, the gift of education sacrificed to the allure of thug life, etc. Not only simplistic, but offensively so. Equally unilluminating were the brainy musings of classmates, accompanied by the requisite, almost haughty, borne back ceaselessly into the past references. The fact was that what he'd been killed over didn't seem any more sinister than what he'd done in college, when the pharmacy he'd opened in his dorm room had seemed as far removed from lethality as the ivory tower itself. I flew alone from LAX to JFK and arrived at 11 on the night before the funeral. Ticanti and a few other Yale classmates were out drinking relatively near my in-law's house in Brooklyn, so I went straight to the bar, my small suitcase clattering on the sidewalk behind me. This was in Clinton Hill, a kind of in-between neighborhood, and the side streets were dark and intimidating. But I reached the bar without incident and sidled up beside my old roommate. The girl whom Rob had set me up with following my college heartbreak, Latasha, was also there. She'd majored in MB&B with Rob and was now a veterinarian in Philadelphia. Ty and I talked about our wives and children, the tribulations of last-minute travel arrangements, the logistics of all of us reaching Newark by train in the morning, anything, it seemed, except Rob himself. Our collective information regarding his death was still limited, which brought forward the sadder fact that, at the end of it all, none of us had actually known Rob as well as we thought we did, as well as we should have, as well as, with just a little more effort, we could have. But we were here. We'd spent the money and made the arrangements and undergone the hassle of gathering to commemorate his death. That at least meant something, as did our subdued toasts to Rob having been a good dude. The next morning I showed up at the apartment where Ty and Latasha were crashing on Eastern Parkway, across the street from the Brooklyn Museum. Ty, as he'd been on his wedding day, was late getting dressed. We boarded the subway a half hour later than we'd planned, got all turned around trying to find the pass station at the World Trade Center, wondering why, a decade after the towers had fallen in our senior year of college, they didn't seem to be building anything yet. Disembarked from the path at the wrong stop, and were swindled by the Newark cab drivers, who charged a flat $20 to take us to the funeral less than a mile from the train station. The trip ended up being so long and error-filled, our laughter over the general incompetence of us Yale graduates so constant, that at a certain point we almost forgot that we were heading to the funeral of someone we'd known and loved. Then we arrived and saw the people gathered outside. The ceremony was at St. Mary's Church, which adjoined the St. Benedict's campus. None of us had ever been to an open casket funeral before. The line for the viewing was 2 blocks long and one of the most diverse collections of people I'd ever seen. Yale students and professors, people conversing in Portuguese and Croatian and Spanish, young and old residents of all the boroughs of New York City and all the townships surrounding Newark, more than 400 people were there. For us, the achingly slow-moving line along Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard took on the aspect of a college reunion without alcohol. Some faces I recognized vaguely as Rob's customers from a decade ago, men and women who'd constantly filed through our common room, wearing hoodies and piercings, uniform in their aversion to uniformity, to sit with Rob in giggly plumes of smoke, railing against university roboculture while feeding live mice to his python. Now they were lawyers and investment bankers, with faces creased and drawn by the skirmish of daily life. Others I'd known well, and as we inched perilously closer to the casket, our talk evidenced a shared fondness for Rob, but also something else shared in our own receding dreams. There was Ty and his dermatology career, me and my struggles to publish a second novel, former history majors who were doing their best to remain in school forever. Nobody, it seemed, was making the money he'd thought he would make, inhabiting the home he'd thought he would inhabit, doing the thing he'd thought he would do in life. Nobody was fulfilling the dreams harbored on graduation day almost 10 years earlier. These uncomfortable observations closely preceded the limbo moments, maybe 15 seconds worth, during which we finally filed inside and faced the embalmed body. Rob's hair had been tightly braided by his cousin Deandre that morning. He was dressed in a black suit with his hands folded at his waist. His head was tipped backward slightly. His skin was waxen, shrunken, scentless, insufficient, and so very still. I'd expected that Rob would look somewhat at ease, peaceful even. But if anything, he looked uncomfortable, like maybe he needed to crack his joints one last time to relieve some pressure inside him. The day was muggy and hot, and the crowded church was stifling. Between the series of hymns and the occasional cracked sob sent a stab of pain through the atmosphere, Friar Leahy gave a long and fiery sermon about the value of human life. I didn't really listen to much of it because I was trying to figure out what I would say when Ty and I went up to the lectern later. Victor had mentioned to me in an email that there would be something like an open mic at the end of the ceremony and anyone could speak, but that comments should be kept under 2 minutes if possible. Ty went before me and promised to establish a scholarship to St. Benedict's and to Yale in Rob's name to resonant applause. There would ultimately be 2 separate efforts in this regard, and neither would gain any traction at all. Donors weren't prone to give money in the name of a drug dealer. Then I was standing there, my gaze panning across those hundreds of faces, every one of whom Rob had known, but only a very few of whom I did. The coffin was beneath the lectern and to the left. Rob's face was obscured by a flower arrangement. I said something about the kung fu movies we used to watch in our dorm room and something else about his grin and how we were all lucky to have known someone with a grin like that. After I stepped down, a funeral crashing evangelist who'd seen the obituary, spoke extensively about the Lord's judgment and how we all needed to go to church more often and pray more devoutly. Then Raquel climbed the 3 steps to the microphone and, through a curtain of tears, spoke of what a gentleman Rob was, what a good friend, what a role model to her son Felix. He taught my son how to shake hands like a man instead of this Puerto Rican kissy-kiss-on-the-cheek thing we do when we greet people, and how he'd always instilled her with confidence. First when she'd been a student, then a young woman, and then, most important, a mother. She said in reference to Jackie, "He knows a good mama when he sees one." Then she concluded, "I don't know where I heard it first, but it takes a long time to grow an old friend." In that way, Rob was like a redwood tree looming large in my life. His life was cut short before it could reach the full heights of its glory. But as I look around this room, I take solace in the fact that so many others thrived and found refuge in his shade while he was with us. I miss you, Rob. I always will. Only a small contingent made it to the burial following the service, maybe 2 dozen people or so. In a small lawn on the fringe of the sprawling Rosedale Cemetery, Rob was buried in his father's plot, which still had no headstone. After a curiously labor-intensive process of straps and pulleys, managed by 2 grunting, sweaty workers, his coffin was set literally on top of Skeet Douglas's. From a heap of flowers at the foot of the plot, we each pulled a lily or a rose and dropped it on the bowed, dark wood. I noticed that there were a lot of pretty women our age weeping, none of whom seemed to know one another. I watched Jackie throughout the burial. She did not cry, though almost all the family members surrounding her did. She was tucked in the middle of them all, like a pillar covered in vines. She looked as she had in our dorm room that day in September of 1998, sullen and impassive and not yet accepting the sheer degree to which she would miss her son. After that, a luncheon was held in St. Benedict's, bright and airy cafeteria, aluminum vats of chicken, rice, and greens. People were laughing and telling stories, some of which involved Rob, some of which didn't. At one point, Friar Leahy approached the table where the remaining Yale contingent sat. Ty and I stood and shook his hand. He told us about the school and its philosophy while showing us a plaque bearing Rob's name as the 1998 Presidential Award winner. He seemed very happy to have a collection of Yale grads in his school, happy that we were there because a boy he had once taught had gone to Yale, had once stood on the cusp of achieving everything that word called to mind. I imagined Rob sitting over his own food in this very room so many hundreds of mornings as both a student and a teacher. I imagined the particular way he ate, hunched over, mouth close to the plate, while his left forearm made a rampart around it, as if someone lurking nearby would try to snatch his meal away. Outside the windows stretched a pristine turf field, where he had played lacrosse with Victor for one season. Beyond that, the Newark skyline cut an industrial picture against the overcast sky. Like college graduation, there always seemed to be another event. The last of the day was at a bar in Bloomfield called ASH, one of Rob's haunts. I took a ride from one of Rob's East Orange friends who, while swerving sharply through the labyrinth of merging Newark streets, told me about the travails of his job selling cars, the lousy commissions. Once we reached the bar, he ordered me a little beer, one of Rob's favorite drinks, which was disgusting, and we had our own toast, though I never even learned the guy's name. Most of the people there, myself included, drank aggressively. Men I didn't recognize were paying hundreds of dollars for bottles of vodka to bring to the tables, as if we were at a nightclub. I talked to Raquel, whom I barely knew, for a while about how weird it was that we were all adults. Oswaldo Gutierrez was there. He was the only one who still looked sober and grim, the expression that a day like this seemed to call for. I didn't know how involved he had been in Rob's life after college. I didn't know how angry he was that day because Rob had never listened to him, because he had enabled Rob to not listen, because Rob had died owing him the $4,000 that had indirectly caused his death. Oswaldo knew better than to blame himself. Rob would have found that money one way or another, and that was one of the hardest things for many of us to accept, that no matter how loosely or intimately intertwined we had been with the life of Rob Peace, our ineffectuality extended far enough to encompass the living and dying of others. So fucking smart, but so fucking dumb. That was how Oswaldo had always characterized his friend, to his face as well as in his consciousness. The words were a refrain in his head that would play on and on and on.
The Burger Boys did not attend the funeral or any of the festivities that followed. Jackie requested their absence, and Nathan communicated this wish to them 2 days after Rob's death. Floey and Drew were mad at first, especially when they learned that the funeral was going to be at St.